You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, and thank you for downloading The Agenda's podcast from today, the 13th of March. And our big topic today was surge pricing. Not for taxis, not for flights, but for restaurants, because an increasing number of takeaway joints in the United States are experimenting with demand-led pricing. Is it something, though, that we could see here in the UAE? We got your comments and we spoke to two food gurus from the restaurant scene right here. We spoke to chef turned consultant Nick Alves and also Gabrielle Mather from Restaurant Secrets, Inc. Meanwhile, Bitcoin's surge is turning people into millionaires every day. That is according to the latest research. But what actually is Bitcoin? We got an explainer from expert Jovana Jovanovic from crypto platform Omla. And as increasing numbers of people choose the UAE for their medical procedures, we looked into the growing field of medical tourism and whether it's likely to impact on our own speedy treatment. We heard from several families who've had relatives come over to deliberately visit the doctor while on holiday. And we spoke to David Hadley from NMC Healthcare, who told us about the most popular treatments. Meanwhile, as two pilots fall asleep while flying a plane in Indonesia, we wanted to find out how frequently it actually happens and whether or not we should be worried. Former pilot and aviation journalist Alistair Rosenshine brought us up to speed. And an urgent health alert has been issued to passengers on an Etihad Airways flight from Abu Dhabi to Dublin. That's after a fellow traveller was found to have measles. But is the disease really such a risk? We found out with Dr. Howard Podolsky. Welcome back to the programme. This is Georgia Tolley here with you. And as you can hear, I've got two very excited studio guests here because we're going to be talking about surge pricing, specifically that sort of increase that we see when it's very busy. So we see it on taxi fares, we see it on tolls, we see it on flights, I suppose holidays, they cost more at popular times as well. So how about meals? Do you think it would be reasonable for restaurants to introduce surge pricing as well? Effectively, they would be charging more at peak hours, like lunchtime or a Friday night. These people that we spoke to, surprisingly, thought it was a good idea.
When I order a pizza, then my mind is made up. I'm going to have a pizza. So whether I have to pay more for that or wait for it to be delivered, I'll do both.
I don't think I would pay more for any of my food, pizza, whatever, at peak times. They're delivering the same thing. Why are they charging me more for it? Absolutely not. I would not.
Because I'm a foodie myself, okay, and I know that the prices and all the costs for the restaurant. And still some restaurants are getting hurt from the COVID period. So I'm okay to pay extra and to see my favorite restaurant is still running. And paying extra dollar or pound or dirham, it doesn't hurt me that much.
We do it for airlines, we do it for hotels, we should do it for restaurants. We already have surge pricing, it just works the other way. It's the business lunch, it's the pre-theatre dinner. It's absolute nonsense that there's some backlash against this. Companies should charge as much as they can for things at a premium time. Charge more for pizzas at lunchtime, now!
You might recognise some of those voices, in particular that last one. That's a Richard Dean there. Now, according to the Wall Street Journal, it's already happening in the United States and they're using AI technology to vary their pricing according to demand, just like taxi services like Uber and Careem do. And the reason why they're doing it is because it's making them more money. There's a guy called Sean Walshef. Hilariously, he runs a barbecue joint in San Diego called Cali Barbecue. He normally charges $18 for a posh sandwich. He normally charges $12 for a posh sandwich. That's on weekday afternoons. But if you order it on Saturday night, it's going to cost you $18. And he says that that decision to do surge pricing has added $1,500 to his four restaurant chains' monthly income of $30,000 for food deliveries. I mean, that is a decent chunk of change. So I'm asking you, would you be happy to pay more to have your pizza delivered, for example, at peak time on a Friday night, or your tacos or on a Tuesday, or, for example, because we're going through, you know, we're in the holy month now, you know, at iftar time, would you be happy to pay more for your takeaway meal that you're using to break your fast? But I have two experts in the studio who are also going to give us their views. First up, I have Nick Alvis. Do I say Alvis or Alves?
Alvis.
Alvis, thank you. Nick Alvis, the chef, you just heard him. He's the chef behind restaurants like Folly, one of my favourites, and he's now the founder of the restaurant consultancy Kitchen Management Solutions, also known as KMS. Thank you for joining us, Nick. Lovely to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Lovely to have you in. It's one of those things where it's weird. I've eaten at your restaurant so many times and now I'm meeting you. It's kind of like a sort of celebrity moment for me. We also have Gabrielle Mather in the studio. She's the founder and CEO of Restaurant Secrets, Inc. Now, Gabrielle and I have spoken a few times before, but this is actually the first time we've met. So thank you so much for coming into the studio. Gabrielle has led the development on over 300 F&B concepts. So we have two veritable gurus from the F&B scene here in the UAE in the studio. And I cannot wait to hear what you guys think about this, because I actually don't know what you think yet. We haven't had time to find out. Nick, I'm going to start with you. What do you think of this idea of surge pricing? Good, bad, or ugly?
I think from my background, what I'm known for, which is slightly higher end dining, but I have been involved in more casual concepts. I think it is a bit more appealing for the casual concept market, because I think they get slammed at weekday lunches, weekend lunches. So many of our favorite venues and restaurants in the city, you kind of avoid them at the busy times, because sometimes the quality suffers. I don't think it's really the restaurant's fault. I feel they're under pressure to take the business, as we all are in this industry, as it's not the biggest margins that we make when it comes to running an actual restaurant, with the staff costs and the food costs now, which is another part of this subject, which is very important, because if these things are going up, which they are, restaurants have to adapt. So that's another part of the subject. But I do feel during these peak periods of a restaurant's daily business and the weekdays and the weekends, I think it is fair for them to moderate how busy they are by putting certain methods in place. And if that means increasing prices to slow the traffic down a little bit to maintain and make sure everything is consistent as they wish it to be, then I think that's fair enough. But that's one side of
the conversation. It's such a difficult conversation.
Yeah,
I mean,
I
was so astonished when we were chatting to people around the office. I was so interested to get different views. And I was really interested about how my view was shifting as I was chatting to people about it. Gabrielle, let's see if you can shift my view even further.
You know, there are so many things I agree with Nick. So I was researching this topic yesterday, and I was actually chatting with my 18-year-old son about it too, just to get another perspective. You know, this is the new generation that's coming into our restaurants. So my view is a bit different, because it comes from being almost three decades in this country. So I celebrate my 28th year this year. So I'm so immersed in the market that I recognize how different it is from the U.S. As just an example, because this topic's coming from the U.S. isn't it?
Yeah.
A market where there are four humans for every one restaurant, versus maybe we have, you know,
one restaurant
for eight.
Yeah. Oh no, it's the other way.
Yeah. So there are eight restaurants for
every
person.
It is the right way.
I've been saying it so many times, and I've been feeling the pressure of it every time I make a new concept. And also as an operator, because I run my own restaurants, it is so difficult to come up with the right strategy. It's always evolving, and I feel the pain of everything, because I'm a business owner and I'm a strategist for other people's businesses. I feel that the right strategy has to match your market demand and supply. So for us, we have a huge supply of restaurants. I don't think we can afford to now go in that direction where people are already having so many choices. And even if they love a particular restaurant, they still have four more or five more that offer similar things to go to or at least to try out. I feel that we need to continue building our brands to a place where we have a standard price during the peak season. So that is a peak that, you know, we price our products for. And then we have the different times, like the business lunches. We have the prefix. We have the special offers. And also for fine dining, because I understand, you know, from where you're coming from, you've got a beautiful produce-based space where, you know, people are coming in expecting the world. I think in those times, using seasonal products to get that value, selling white truffle at the premium at the right season, people will buy it. It's not a problem. Yeah. But then, you know, working the other way around, I think it's a, I don't think it will work. From my experience, I think having a set price and then having great other offers to fill up the low season is the way to go because of purely the amount of supply we have in the market. That's what I think.
Really interesting to get that sort of laying the groundwork view from both of you. We're going to go to a quick break now, and I'm going to get everyone to text in and say what they think about it. We've already had loads of messages coming in, which is fantastic. 4001 is the way to text, or you can WhatsApp me on 04871 5500. Asad just says no, which is succinct and to the point. So that's a no to surge pricing. Matthew says, my personal view is that surge pricing is actually unethical. But if ride-hailing companies and airlines can engage in surge pricing, then others should be allowed to do the same. What is your view? Get in touch with me. We'd love to love you to join the conversation. We are going to be coming back to our two experts in the next few minutes. Delighted to have Nick Alvis, the chef behind restaurants like Folly and the founder of the restaurant consultancy Kitchen Management Solutions, and also Gabrielle Mather, who's the founder and CEO of Restaurant Secrets. Both sticking with me in the studio. We'll get more of their views next.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back to The Agenda, continuing our conversation about surge pricing for food. We see it on taxi fares. We see it on flights. We see it on holidays. We all know that a package holiday during the school vacations end up costing more. So how about meals? Would it be reasonable for restaurants to introduce surge pricing, for example, on their takeaways? Riyadh has got in touch saying surge pricing for food is ridiculous. It is not as if they are delivering it. So it sounds like Riyadh might be happy to pay more for the delivery process, but not necessarily for the meal itself. We've had other comments coming in here. Matthew says, my personal view is that surge pricing of all kinds is unethical. But if ride-hailing companies and airlines can engage in surge pricing, then others should be allowed to do the same. Please do keep your comments coming. We were mid-conversation there with Nick Alvis, who is the chef behind restaurants like Folly. He's now the founder of the restaurant consultancy Kitchen Management Solutions. We're also chatting to Gabrielle Mather. She's the founder and CEO of Restaurant Secrets, Inc. She's actually led the development of over 300 F&B concepts. So we really had two gurus in the studio. And I asked Nick whether restaurants would be justified in adopting a surge pricing model.
Where do I start? Yeah, I mean, I think the 12-month calendar year is challenging, especially here. It's a very seasonal city, so we have best part of 6 months, which are great, and the best part of 6 months, which not 6 months in a row, but, you know, put it all together and you've got 6 months great, 6 months questionable, and some months incredibly challenging. So you have to balance everything out over the 12 months. I do feel that, the food cost is an issue. I'm a chef, so obviously that comes to mind straight away. But I also, you know, I'm a chef operator. And I launch concepts, design concepts. So I'm aware of the other costs involved, and they're huge. Manning staff is the biggest cost to a restaurant. Obviously, you want to provide a great service for your customers and your guests. And then the food, if you want to buy quality and serve quality, which is my background, to be honest, I'm very, very proud of that fact. And it's a huge focus in whoever I work with, whatever menus I work with, whatever chefs I work with, My ethos is fresh, fresh produce, seasonal produce. I would say you can spend more than you need to on certain things. So you also need to have an education on the produce that you're using. Mm. You need to know your local market, your vegetable market, for example, your seafood market, which we're lucky enough to have here. But costs are increasing day to day with all these issues that are going on in the world as well. It's getting harder and harder. And I'm not sure many people consider that when they're ordering their pizza.
Well, they definitely don't. I mean, what's so interesting is how furious some people who are texting in, how furious they are about the idea of paying more for their restaurant food. And I think maybe, Gabriel, that comes back to what you mentioned a little bit earlier, the fact that there are, how many was it, 8 restaurants to every person here, or 6 restaurants?
I think that's the numbers. We don't always get published numbers in this part of the world, but this was a report by KPMG quite a few years back that I still hold on to and I rely on, and you can see it happening. It's what I'm saying is, even if we cannot measure it by physically going out there and take it from the DET, but we can see the number of restaurants we have per person. I so agree with everything Nick said, because as a business owner, as a business consultant, as an operator, we all know the cost of the prime cost, the labor and the food cost, that's the highest. Yeah. We also know it's a very seasonal market here. Unfortunately, even though so much is being done to bring in traffic, we still have a very limited time of the year to make money. But as a business strategist, as an incubator of businesses, I always look at the solution coming to a problem from ethics, from demand and supply, and then build your strategy, the best strategy, because ultimately you need that consumer to come in. And if anything you're doing is making them walk away to a competitor or just not to your business, it is not working. So it has to work. For me, a strategy has to work. So I still feel that if we were to set our prices at a level where we are so comfortable that we're costing our numbers at the peak prices regularly, and then dropping them to a good level, not a loss-making level, but at a win-win level during other parts of the year, and understanding that these hybrid seasons where we don't have that income can be used for other things, for other ventures, going out into markets, catering, you know, doing other things. If people are not coming to you, you're going to them. There are different ways to spread that bottom line, to bring in income. I feel any decision we make that consumers feel is unethical, or is making them spend more than they're ready to, and they don't see value in it, will just drive people away. So I believe that strategies are important, and they need to evolve as the market evolves. And our strategies have to be so aligned to how the market is responding to these kind of things. And we can see that from what's coming in. People will pay for quality, but that quality is a set standard. It's not that because it's December and I have a lot of business, so my quality is better today. Your quality is overall over the year. And when you bring it down, like when you do a brunch, you don't bring your quality down. You're still giving that quality, but you're just making it valuable.
I've got literally 10 seconds left with both of you, but you've just brought up brunches, and it just made me think, I've always wondered, do restaurants make money on brunches, or are they a loss leader designed to bring people in?
If you get your costing right, which we call the cost of goods, that means you get the right partners for your alcohol, for your food, for your entertainment. And if you've got good volume, it covers certain amount. If nothing else, it's a marketing tool to bring people in, to create that ambience, to create that atmosphere so your other days can work well. So for me, it's always worked that way.
Was that the same for you, Nick? Did you do a brunch at Folly?
We did actually. Yeah. And it was really popular, but It's all about showcasing the venue, showcasing what we do, what we're about, and it's bringing people back. It's the return.
Yeah. Nick Alves there, the chef behind restaurants like Folly, now the founder of the restaurant consultancy Kitchen Management Solutions. Also, Gabrielle Mather, who's the founder and CEO of Restaurants Secrets, Inc. Love to get your comments on this. Really, really enjoying what everyone's saying. A lot of people very, very anti it indeed. M has just said they increase the prices in restaurants all the time. Prices are already sky high. Who's going to suffer? suffer with the increasing cost. It's going to be the low-income people. One anonymous person here says, I think it's actually justifiable, provided the restaurant can make a commitment to quality control and delivery time.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there. Welcome back to the programme. This is The Agenda on Dubai Eye 103.8. And we're going to turn our attention to a story that we wouldn't normally consider on this programme, but it sort of burst into the mainstream because Bitcoin is breaking records every single day. And it's got this huge rally on at the moment, and it's soared around 70% already this year.
Currencies on Dubai Eye 103.8.
So currencies of the crypto variety continue to dominate the FX market. Bitcoin setting new record highs above $72,000. And don't forget Ethereum above $4,000 right now. Crypto's really on a roll, minting lots more Bitcoin billionaires.
So there you go. That is Richard Dean. For a moment, I thought, oh, my goodness, what have I just pressed? That was Richard Dean on the Business Breakfast show. And that is very much symptomatic of what they've been saying every single day, because Bitcoin does appear to be creating 1,500 new crypto millionaires daily. That's according to an analytics firm called Keiko Research. They can analyze people's digital wallets on the Bitcoin blockchain. I don't understand that either. Although it is worth noting that they can't tell who people are because the addresses are private. They're anonymous. So it might be, it's hard to know whether those are individuals or entities, for example. But let's be honest, most of us don't really know what Bitcoin is, and we don't know whether we should therefore be buying it or not buying it, or whether all of this is just some sort of ephemeral thing for bankers. So we wanted to get a quick explainer, and joining me now in the studio is someone who really does know a great deal about it. Jovana Jovanovic. Jovanovic is the co-founder and CEO of Omla, which is a platform that aims to provide access for Arabic speakers to basically get into crypto. I hope I've described that right as well. But anyway, Jovana joins me in the studio. Thank you so much for your time. How are you?
All is well. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's lovely to have you here. I'm sorry I've completely massacred your name. I will get it right next time. But let's start with the idea of what is Bitcoin. Let's start with that initial very simple question, which hopefully has a vaguely simple answer.
So, you know, it's an interesting question because I think what we've historically had is something that is money and something separate that is payment and something separate that is assets. And I think the beauty of Bitcoin is something like this has never really existed before. Bitcoin is a currency. It is an asset. It is a payment layer. It is a settlement layer. It is a store of value. It's so many different things in one. And I think it's a bit difficult for a lot of people to grasp because it fills so many different parts of the financial and technology world.
Yeah. And oddly enough, you notice that on the Business Breakfast because they do the commodities market and they do the currencies market, and they actually don't know where to put Bitcoin, whether it's a currency or whether it's a commodity. And they kind of tend to vacillate each day according to their mood. So, but what is it?
I mean, it's all of the above, right? So it's all of the above. Plus it's a technology that people can build on top of. And there's so many interesting projects being built on top of the Bitcoin ecosystem to facilitate mass adoption. And I think the sort of definition that most people probably would associate with Bitcoin is a form of currency or some sort of money, right? And I think, you know, if we sort of almost take one step back and say, you know, what is it that if Bitcoin is some sort of currency or some sort of money or some sort of value of exchange, why is it that it has
any value?
Exactly. And I think you kind of have to go back to the history of money and why any money has got value altogether, and maybe even ask the question about what is money? What is money to begin with?
Because if you hold a piece of paper now that says 100 dirhams on it, that piece of paper is not worth 100 dirhams. It's representative of 100 dirhams.
Exactly. And I think Elon Musk had an absolutely fantastic definition for what money actually is. The money is just data that allows people to avoid the inconvenience of barter. And I think that's fantastic, right? So it kind of describes this medium of exchange where we started off pre-money time saying, well, I have a bale of wheat. You're maybe a shoemaker. I want to give you my bale of wheat for a pair of shoes. But then the problem came in and said, well, I'm a shoemaker, but I don't actually need any wheat right now. So it became problematic. And we needed to have this intermediary value of exchange that was equally valuable for you and equally valuable for you as well. So, and I think this is where money really started, as the form of rare ancient seashells and coffee beans. But money's been so many different things over the years, and then it became gold. And we have to ask, why did these things have value over time as a medium of exchange to replace barter? And there's a couple of different properties of why money has value, and it has to have a few of these things, which you'll see are present across the likes of gold and currency and Bitcoin as well, which is money has to be divisible. So you can't have one massive lump of gold bars, right? It needs to be divisible into small little coins or and gold was at one stage the currency of use, right? It's the oldest currency of use.
So why is Bitcoin suddenly worth so much money?
Well, it takes some of these points as to why money has value, but then there's an added layer on top of that. So Bitcoin is divisible. It is a scarce asset. There's only 21 million Bitcoins ever in existence. It's portable, so you can send it across the world. It's verifiable. You can check this is a real Bitcoin. So I mentioned that there's 21 million Bitcoins, but those 21 million Bitcoins do not exist all at once. There can never be more. There can never be less. So you can't change the fixed supply. There's a fixed scarce supply to say.
But 21. Who made them?
So it was made by someone anonymous called Satoshi. Nobody knows who it is. It could be a person. It could be an organization. But what they programmed into this programmable money is that every 4 years, the supply of Bitcoin basically decreases in how much you mine Bitcoin. And allow me to explain that for a minute. So Bitcoin started off, there were no Bitcoins in existence. Then computers had to do a bit of work in order to generate Bitcoin. Every single block that they essentially mine generates 50 Bitcoin in 2009. And every 4 years, that reward for the miners actually goes in half. So the supply of Bitcoin every single 4 years goes down. However, when you look at how many people have been coming into the space, the demand has been growing. So this is a simple economics, supply, demand. There's less Bitcoin coming into the ecosystem, more people wanting it. It's got the right attributes of what money and value really is. And I think this is why we're at the stage of where we are today.
It's absolutely fascinating. I think it might be beyond my knowledge. I think it might be beyond my understanding. I think it's one of those things that I need to do more reading in. But Giovanna, thank you so much for giving us that short and sharp explanation. We really appreciate you joining us in the studio. It's what your knowledge stretches so far beyond there that I feel slightly guilty asking you such simple questions, but we really needed to know. So thank you so much for your time. Giovanna Jovanovic is the co-founder and CEO of Omla, which aims to provide a platform for Arabic speakers to access crypto. Thank you so much for joining me in the studio. Thanks for your time. Thank you.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there and welcome back to the programme. Lovely to have you with us. Now, we're going to take a look at health tourism on the show now. That is off the back of evidence that the UAE clearly seems to be forging ahead as a destination for potential patients. Now, we've been looking at the most recent figures, and it looks like they're from 2022, but they were published in April 23. So we're coming up to getting the latest ones, but we jumped the gun a bit. So we're going to look back on the last figures, which shows that Dubai welcomed 674,000 patients. And they spent 992 million dirhams. I think it's fair to say that health tourism is doing pretty well here, particularly because that was actually up 25% on the previous year. And the theory is that some medical systems in some countries are really struggling to cover post-pandemic, which means that the UAE and specifically Dubai, with its very speedy and fulsome health service, is becoming very attractive indeed. Now, producer Jennifer Crichton experienced that health system recently as a tourist. Obviously, Jen, you're not the tourist,
But you had a tourist, didn't you?
I did. My mum, I took to the hospital when they were visiting recently. So my mum had had what we thought was a diagnosis on the NHS in the UK, but hadn't really been given an awful lot of information by her doctor because the appointments there are about 3 minutes long if you can get one. So she was very worried, very concerned, went and had a biopsy, was told it would take 8 weeks for the results to come back. Obviously was quite unsettled by that. So while she was here, I took her to see a specialist, and she was so reassured by her sort of 15-minute appointment here that she walked out and burst into tears. She was immediately given an appointment for tests on the Saturday morning, went in and did tests, and had her results back by the Monday when she flew back out. So a process that had taken about 6 months, in the UK, and has been ongoing, I should say, for a decade, was sorted out in 3 days here. And I was concerned when I suggested it that perhaps it would prove to be a bit of a laborious process trying to get someone to see a consultant and have testing and everything done when they're not resident in the country. It was so smooth. The minute, wow, I told the hospital she's visiting, they went, that's fine. We've got your number in the system. We'll attach a new profile to your number. Bring her passport with you. Separate queue to pay. Paid in the pharmacy. Got her sort of jumped the queue effectively in the pharmacy because she was paying cash and not insurance. We were in and out without any issues at all.
That's absolutely amazing. I mean, I have my own sort of family story in that my sister comes over, and every time she visits, luckily she's not here now, so she won't be embarrassed by this, but you know, she sees the gynecologist here rather than the one in her sort of rural community in the United Kingdom. It's worth mentioning that both of these stories are from the UK, where the healthcare system is particularly under pressure, isn't it?
Although it should be said, not the key market for healthcare tourism here. Actually, the majority of patients who are coming into the UAE for health tourism purposes are coming from Asia. Europe is the secondary market, but the majority are coming from Asia. So it is, although our examples are British, because obviously that's where our families are, this is not a specifically British or European problem. This is, we are seeing people coming from across the globe.
Really interesting. Come and get in touch, 4001, or you can WhatsApp me on 04871 5500. If you've had friends or family who've visited the doctor here, I'd be really interested to know if they were like proper health tourists. Did they come here to get treatment? And what they actually got, you know, what they went for. Because obviously we see all those cosmetic clinics along Jumeirah Beach Road, for example. And there's also lots in Abu Dhabi as well. But I wonder whether that is what's proving the most popular. Now, don't just take our words from it. We've also had lots of people getting in touch saying that their relatives have been to the doctor. This is Rachel.
My mother-in-law came to stay for a month, and she asked if I could take her to a dermatologist. Because she had a little sore on her face, which she felt she couldn't get rid of and wouldn't get better. So I took her along to the dermatologist, which is around the corner from us, and she immediately recognised it as a precancerous sore, which hopefully will prevent further complications in the near term. But she reckons it would have taken her 6 months to even get a consultant appointment, to even have a look at her face, and probably more than that. And then secondly, my father, who's elderly, he's 86, he arrived and immediately said, I need to have a minor procedure. I've been waiting 3 months. He's been now been told it's another 6 to 8 weeks wait, at least. So if he has to wait 8 weeks, then it will be almost 7 months from when he was first told that he needed this procedure. And we still don't have a guarantee that it is going to be done. Say that is going through the private system in the UK. So yes, I feel like medical tourism is on the up.
Just a few stories there. We are now joined on the line by David Hadley. He's the CEO of NMC Healthcare. David, lovely to have you with us. It sounds like health tourism is on the up. Is that something that you guys have experienced at NMC?
Hi, Georgia. Yeah, thank you for having me on the show. And Jen, I hope your mom's okay. I've had similar stories of bringing my family out from the UK as well, because it's obviously a way of expediting our treatment. Yes, medical tourism is on the up for us. We have at NMC, we have a dedicated team that focuses on medical tourism. And I'm happy to report that our statistics are tracking what the UAE statistics are. We've seen a 27% increase in this last quarter versus last year in terms of inquiries coming in to our hospital business. So yes, it is on the up.
27% just in the last quarter. That's extraordinary.
Yes.
My goodness me. Yeah. Do we, I mean, my immediate question, because I'm a classic NIMBY, as in a, not, it's an expression from the United Kingdom, not in my backyard. I immediately start to worry about my own appointments. You know, am I going to have to start queuing? Is the UAE getting too popular? Will I not be able to see a consultant at the drop of a hat?
No, I don't think you need to worry about that. The good news is that the UAE is an attractive destination for people to want to live and work. And as a result, we can continue to add capacity by attracting doctors to the UAE and clinicians and like. And you've probably seen that the healthcare market has expanded at the same pace as the UAE has expanded. So you shouldn't have any problems getting an appointment.
That is very good news. Now, in the coming minutes, I want to find out from you what type of treatments people are coming from, what proves the most popular, and if people are listening to this and thinking, well, hang on a second, maybe I should get my relatives over. Next time they're over for a holiday, they could go to the doctor. We're going to get into the details of just how easy that is.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there and welcome back to the programme. We are discussing health tourism on the show today. Looking back, first of all, on figures that came out a few months ago that suggest that in 2022, Dubai welcomed nearly 700,000 patients from abroad and they spent nearly 992 million dirhams. Now, that was up 25% on the last year. We've just heard from David Hadley, who's the CEO of NMC Healthcare, that they have seen an uplift of 27% just in the last quarter. So it sounds like the UAE is really doing incredibly well when it comes to health tourism. But what are people coming to get? What type of treatments are proving the most popular? Well, I've managed to keep David Hadley on the line despite his extreme busyness. Let's find out, David, what are the most popular treatments? Is it cosmetic or is it proper medical?
So I think first of all, at NMC Healthcare, we have a few verticals. We have a cosmetics business called Cosmesurge and Aesthetics, which expands across the UAE. They, around about 11% of those patients are medical tourism patients, so a big component of the patient profile. They come for various things, from Botox to breast augmentation to liposuction, etc. So quite a big component, if you like, of the cosmetics business. We also have an IVF chain, which is called Faki IVF, and around about 16% of their patient profile are medical tourism, and obviously they're coming for infertility treatment, so it's a large component of that business too. Obviously, of the larger hospital group, it's a much, much smaller population group, but is growing quite rapidly. And patients are coming in for everything, from neuro and spinal to orthopedics to oncology, urology, general surgery. So basically anything patients are coming to the UAE for. And I think it's a very positive sign and reflects well on the UAE healthcare system as a whole.
So when Jen and I were doing research on this, Jen discovered a page from the Dubai Health Authority, which is devoted to facilitating health tourism. There's a whole standalone program which they call DXH, which is quite clever because, of course, it's a bit like DXB. And if you go on that page, patients can find, you know, all the info they'd need, you know, flights, hotels, and then there's 50 hospitals and clinics that offer all sorts of services. You guys are involved in that program. How significant is it from your business perspective? I mean, we've heard how many patients you've got coming in there, but obviously they're spending money, you know, compared to people who are claiming on the insurance potentially. You know, how big a component is of your business is it?
Well, right now it's still very small as a percentage of the overall business. I mentioned the cosmetics and the IVF, the 11 and the 16%. But of the overall business, it's around about 1%. So it's still quite small. But as we reported, it's growing quite rapidly. And Dubai has done extremely well in establishing their medical tourism office. I remember going with them to Russia many, many years ago. I can't even remember how many years ago, 10 years ago. And this was a hot topic back then already. I think the way that the UAE specifically handled COVID put us on the map in terms of being a quality healthcare destination. It was well reported how we how we manage the COVID pandemic, and people are now moving to the UAE as a result of the good healthcare systems that are available. So it's the initiatives have certainly added value and are now starting to drive the business performance too.
Yeah, it was very much globally reported that the UAE was a sort of a winner when it came to its COVID management strategies. How about our competitors? We have this anonymous message in here saying India also has an excellent healthcare system for a fraction of the cost. Are there any comparisons?
Yeah, I think it's important to understand why people travel for healthcare. We talked, Jen mentioned earlier, lack of access. That's one of the key reasons that people travel for healthcare. The other is the quality of the healthcare. In some countries, underdeveloped countries, people are looking for quality healthcare. They might have access, but it's not good enough. And the third one, which is a big one, is price. If you look at our competitors on price, if you will, clearly India and Thailand have very good healthcare systems and are growing, but they offer it at a fraction of the cost of the UAE. One of the biggest drivers of price is actually obviously the salaries that we pay to the staff members. Around 70% of the costs in healthcare provider side are around alpha salaries. And as a result, the salaries on offer in the UAE are significantly higher than what you would pay a doctor in, say, India or Thailand, because of the cost of living index here in the UAE. So it's very difficult for us to compete on price with countries like India and Thailand. But certainly in terms of quality, we're right up there, and we're able to compete with even the Western countries in that regard.
How about the impact that it's going to have on waiting times and demand? Now, I know I asked you this a little bit earlier on, but is there any suggestion that with this influx of tourists that we could find ourselves having to wait for appointments to see consultants? Because I think we've all got quite spoiled over here. We're very used to seeing a doctor at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, I don't think it, well, it shouldn't, because it's very easy for us, not very easy, it's comfortable for us to attract medical professionals to this country. As a result of the salaries that are on offer, there's a global shortage of nurses and doctors, but people want to live in the UAE. It's a high income country. It's a great place to live. So should the demand increase, all the healthcare providers, including ourselves, would look to increase our capacity and increase the availability of doctors. So I don't see that as being a significant challenge, no.
And growth areas, you mentioned the IVF market, very popular here, also the cosmetic market. Do you see any other sort of specific healthcare areas that are set to grow?
I think as the market evolves, as we evolve as a market into being into preventative care, I, for one, believe that people will come here to get their medical checkups. This is a big driver in other countries, Switzerland specifically, and many other the Western world. This is an area that's still underdeveloped in the UAE. Also for geriatric care, lack of access in other, if you like, European countries where the population's a lot older. We're still evolving that business model as the UAE, and I think that will attract people to this market as well. But the traditional things such as orthopedics, general surgery, cancer checkups, etc. I know you read a patient as message earlier who came in to get her skin examined. So I think we'll see an increase in all the general, if you like, healthcare needs, but specifically around preventative care and geriatric care. As we evolve those business models, I think we will start to see an even bigger influx of medical tourists.
David Hadley, the CEO of NMC Healthcare. Always great to get you on the radio. Thank you very much indeed for your time. Very interesting to hear there about how health tourism is developing right here in the UAE. Specifically, I think it's fair to say, in Dubai. Do keep your comments coming. So many people getting in touch saying that they've, you know, brought in their relatives, their friends and their relatives, and while they were having a holiday, they've nipped to the doctor and got something sorted out.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Hello there and welcome back to The Agenda. Lovely to have you listening. It's just after 11:53. And we're now going to look at a topic that I have to admit I have a slight personal interest in. But I think maybe anyone who travels on a plane would have a personal interest in this one. Because Indonesian authorities are investigating after two pilots fell asleep while flying their plane from Sulawesi to the capital, Jakarta. It was a Batik airplane. The sleeping session lasted 28 minutes, and the Airbus A320 did briefly veer off course. Luckily, eventually it landed safely, and all 153 passengers and crew members were unharmed. So how did it happen? Well, basically, the first pilot said to his co-pilot, "Can you take control for half an hour or so? Because, you know, I just need to have a bit of a rest." The co-pilot apparently agreed, but then inadvertently fell asleep as well. And according to a report from the Transport Ministry, he was tired because he had 1 month old twins and he'd been helping out with the nights. Joining me now to discuss the case is former pilot and aviation journalist Alistair Rosenshein, joining us on Teams. Alistair, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. How often does this type of thing happen?
Well, it's quite rare, but it does happen. And certainly I can't think of any pilots who haven't experienced, sleepiness and, in fact, dropping off to sleep at the controls. Now, you have two pilots, so the idea is that you tell the other one that you're just going to close your eyes for a few minutes and they mind the shop, they continue controlling the aircraft. The problem arises, of course, if the other pilot falls asleep too. And whilst that is quite rare, it does happen. And that's because we're human beings.
Okay, I'm now more worried, Alistair. I'm more disconcerted. Like, are there mechanisms in place to wake up pilots if this happens, if two accidentally drop off?
Well, it's a very good question. And the answer is a straight no, there isn't. There are no mechanisms whatsoever. The onus is upon all flight crew to be properly rested before they fly. But things can become complicated if the rostering, that's the flights that the pilots do, are a mixture of, say, days and nights or early mornings and nights. And it's very, very difficult to maintain, an alertness throughout a long flight. And now this particular flight we're talking about was only about 2.5 hours. But it was very early in the morning, and that is when it is most difficult to stay awake between 2 and 6 a.m. And anybody who's driven a car down a motorway or a long time, you start to drop off. You notice it and you think, crumbs, I better pull over and take a nap. But every now and then you hear of a motorist who's actually had an accident because of it. Now, I have to say here that it is far more dangerous in a car or lorry if you fall asleep than in an aircraft, because in an aircraft, in the cruise, you have the autopilot in and it's programmed to the route. So the aircraft will continue flying the route. Of course, if the pilots are asleep, they're not monitoring the systems or making radio calls. But generally speaking, it's not going to be an immediate risk as it is in a car.
Now, the pilots I know, and we know quite a few, there's so many over here in the UAE, they're really responsible when it comes to sleep. They're real pedants. You know, you might be out for dinner with a pilot and someone might say, no, let's push on through for a couple of hours. Let's go for another drink. And the pilots I know are like, no, I'm flying tomorrow. That cannot be done. You know, to start with, they do checks on us. And secondly, I consider it, part of my job to be really very responsible indeed. So what are the tests that airlines do to check that pilots are fit to fly? Do they do them just before each flight?
No, they most certainly don't do them before every flight. They do it, pilots, I'm talking here about the UK and Europe, but pilots under the age of 40 have a medical once a year. Over 40, it's every 6 months. But this is completely separate from what we're dealing with here, which is, falling asleep, basically rest. And, every single human being has a circadian rhythm. And they will be awake during the day and asleep at night. But pilots have to fly during the night as well as during the day. And therein lies the problem. Shift workers who are working every single night, all they do is work at night. Then they sleep during the day and they work at night. They get into a rhythm and they're able to stay awake. But with pilots, you end up with this mix of day and night flights. And that's a real problem because, no matter how well rested you are or try to rest, I should emphasize try to rest, because you're not necessarily able to sleep during the day in order to do your flight at night. So you try, you lie in bed, you have the lights off. Occasionally you'll find that it's very difficult to stay awake. So you are allowed, most airlines will allow pilots to take a nap, but one at a time, obviously. And, and some airlines actually stipulate that a cabin crew member should be on the flight deck with so they're able to interact with the pilot who's still awake. And also on long flights, most airlines have bunk rest. So the pilots actually go to bed. They take it in turns and you have an extra flight crew member or maybe two extra pilots on board so that you can have half the flight in bed. And then on those flights, there's, you know, there is no problem staying awake. It's the two crew operations early in the morning or late at night that the problem arises.
Really interesting to get a little bit of a sort of behind the scenes reality check there. Alistair Rosenshine, a former pilot and aviation journalist, thank you so much for your time. It makes you realize how much trust we put in our pilots. Hello there. Welcome back to The Agenda. Right, we're going to turn our attention to that breaking news story straight away because passengers on an Etihad Airways flight that went from Abu Dhabi to Dublin are being warned to sort of keep an eye on their health. That's after a fellow traveller was found to have measles. So, I mean, what's really interesting is they've actually issued an urgent health alert. That was issued by Ireland's Health Service executive, and it's being sent to all the travellers on the plane, which landed in the Irish capital at 6:30 on Saturday. I was really surprised by this, but basically the health body is advising passengers who are pregnant, immunocompromised, or who have children under the age of 12 months to come forward. I had no idea that measles was something that people needed to be so worried about, worried enough for an urgent health alert to be issued. Let's find out more about this. I'm joined on the line by a man in the know, Dr. Howard Podolsky. He's the group CEO of the Cambridge Medical and Rehabilitation Centre in the GCC, based here in Abu Dhabi, I believe. Dr. Podolsky, thank you so much for joining me on the line. How are you?
I'm well. Great to be with you today. Thanks.
Good to have you with us, particularly because I don't get this topic. I don't get this alert. No. I didn't think measles was that big a deal. Don't we all get vaccinated against measles near birth?
Well, we used to. And in fact, your concerns and your thought process make perfect sense because most of us do get vaccinated usually in our first year of life and then somewhere between the ages of 4 and 6. And that usually does just fine for the vast majority of us who get the two-dose vaccination. Unfortunately, we've seen a significant rise in the number of measles cases over the past 5 years, more specifically over the past 3 years, especially post-pandemic. And that has a lot to do with individuals who are either not getting the vaccinations or only getting one out of the two vaccinations and not getting fully covered and protected by the measles vaccine. So we're seeing a significant increase in the UK and in Europe and throughout other parts of the world as well. And I think that's where the concern is beginning to become heightened.
What is measles and why do people need to be worried about it?
Sure. Measles is a viral illness. It's been around forever and a day. And it's generally a self-limited viral illness. It has the characteristic rash that most people know about. It's called a macular papular rash. It starts in the face, head and neck, and spreads down to the trunk and the extremities. But before we get the rash, we have cold-like symptoms, runny nose, watery eyes, cough, sneezing. So oftentimes people confuse it with run-of-the-mill upper respiratory tract infections. What makes measles a little bit different from other types of respiratory illnesses is that it's extremely contagious. It's spread through small particle droplets, similar to the way COVID had been spread, only it's much more contagious than COVID. And for the vast majority of individuals who do unfortunately get sick with measles, they generally do quite well. The illness lasts for about a week to 10 days. It's self-limited. The rash goes away. The symptoms abate, and we move on. But for immunocompromised, for pregnant mothers, for young children, there is the risk of more severe disease, which includes pneumonia, or for that matter, even infections in the brain, such as encephalitis, which can lead to blindness, seizures, and other neurological abnormalities. Again, that's for a subset of the individuals, not for the average individual who comes down with measles.
Okay, so if you're listening to this and you're suddenly thinking, hang on a second, I'm not sure I've had a measles vaccine. I'm not sure my kids have had a measles vaccine. Can you have one at any age?
The short answer is yes, absolutely you can. Most adults have been vaccinated, but if you're unsure as to whether or not you had a two vaccination dosing, you can always get a booster. That's easy to do, and any health clinic, any center can provide that for you. If you have children and you're not sure whether or not your children are vaccinated, get them vaccinated. If you're unsure as to whether they had the second vaccination and perhaps only had the first, go ahead and get that. The two doses typically need to be separated by about 28 to 30 days if the two doses are needed. But absolutely anybody can get an extra vaccination if needed. It certainly will support additional immunoprotection. And the vaccines we know are extremely effective at protecting us against the onset of measles to the tune of about 97% effective.
Okay, so this health alert gives the impression that the Irish Health Authority aren't just worried about people who've been on the plane getting measles, mm-hmm. but of it spreading amongst the community.
Yes.
Are we, the Irish community, I guess, are we now in a situation where we no longer have herd immunity in European countries? Because you'd think that everyone had been vaccinated, and it doesn't matter if you've got like four people wandering around with measles because we're all vaccinated anyway.
In the perfect world, you're absolutely correct. But the concern among epidemiologists is that herd immunity, as you rightly stated, is slipping. Typically, to get herd immunity with measles, you'd need about 85 to 90% or more of the population to be vaccinated. Unfortunately, over the last several years, the numbers of individuals who have been fully vaccinated against measles has been slipping for a variety of reasons. Misinformation about vaccinations, lack of access during COVID, and so on, has created a situation where we've seen a significant increase in the rise of measles throughout Europe and the UK. So the health authorities have every reason to be concerned because that herd immunity is not as robust as it used to be.
Dr. Howard Podolsky, fantastic to get you joining us on the line today. Thank you so much for responding so quickly to Jen's request. This story just broke this morning and we are super keen to cover it on the programme today. So really lovely to speak to Dr. Howard there. He's the Group CEO of the Cambridge Medical and Rehabilitation Centre in the GCC. Thank you so much for your time. The Agenda is live Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. till 1 p.m.